Welcome to Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. This is the Overthinking It book club for Ender's Game, chapters 9 and 10. 9, Locke and Demosthenes, and 10, Dragon. It's called Dragon, isn't it?
Yes, right. Dragon, just Dragon, yes.
That is the voice of Ben Adams, the world's foremost expert on Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. I'm Matthew Rather. I'm reading the book for the first time, and we are discussing chapters 9 and 10. So if you're just jumping on, the Overthinking It Book Club is a chance for us to kind of expand our examination of a work a little bit. We have an introductory post where we've published reading assignments, weekly reading assignments, all of about the same length, and we are considering those piece by piece in a podcast and in forums, in the forums on the site. So we would like to, you know, we would like to hear from you. We'd like you to check out the forums, which are at overthinkingit.com/forums, and you can find book club and the individual forums for the chapters, the reading assignments, and you'll be safe from spoilers in there, in the individual discussion forums for the week. And there's also now one for the entire book. So if you've already read Ender's Game before and want to comment or take off or disagree from something we say, and pull in evidence from all over the book, you have a place where you can do that, and all spoilers for Ender's Game are allowed there. Again, you can find those at overthinkingit.com/forums. And we tried it last week, and I think it's very good to highlight something from the forums. So this week we're going to highlight a comment or a forum post, I guess. They're not comments unless they're on the blog. So many words for such similar things. The comment from Fizzled in response to the study questions for chapters 7 and 8, Fizzled writes in and says, "The longer I listen to this week's book club, the more I started thinking about the importance of the third trope. It's not just that Ender is considered weak or an afterthought. It's that he represents a third alternative to what's perceived as a binary set of solutions. He's obviously presented as a third alternative to Valentine and Peter, the middle ground between indiscriminate violence and control, and idealized empathy and love." Though actually, Fizzle, this is Matt interjecting. I think we're going to interject in that, because we talk about in chapter 9, Valentine kind of reflects on her capacity to control through empathy. That's sort of interesting. Fizzle continues, "With respect to the giant's drink, he's shown choosing a third option rather than the binary choice." And then there are more examples. But Fizzle goes on nearer the bottom to say, "It seems very deliberate that Ender's position in the most rigid and regimented army, Salamander, and the loosest, most juvenile army, Rat, his success is reliant on a middle ground strategy that is rarely obvious before he gets there, but with our vantage point as adults who have already read the book, seems like the only logical choice after seeing how the conflicts are structured." So we can talk a little bit about that also, about sort of Ender's style as a commander as he has given his own army. So thank you, Fizzled, for that insight. I think it's really interesting to kind of, yeah, Ender does kind of find a door number three, right? Or a third way, or a sort of middle way. And it's interesting to think of that not simply as an average, not simply as the middle point between two, but a whole other direction that Ender takes things in. So for chapters 9 and 10, let's just do a little bit of plot summary. Ben, what takes place, what transpires in chapters 9 and 10?
Well, this is our first visit back with Peter and Val. It's appropriately titled Locke and Demosthenes, and this is where we find out how to use Reddit to conquer the world. or Overthinking It, of course, where you can leverage your positions on the Overthinking It forum to gain world dominance. But we check back in with Val, and it's some time has passed. She's reflecting on Ender's 8th birthday, so this is now basically a year after the last, one of the last things we've seen of Ender was his 7th birthday. So it's been about a year. And she reflects on kind of Peter's new position and Peter's, the effect that their family's move to the more rural areas had on Peter. And then Peter starts talking to Val about his reading of the current political situation. And this is the, Dink was the first one to raise it. And now Peter's re-raising this issue that things are happening, that after, you know, a century, presumably, of the international fleet dominating the stage, the political things are happening, that he wants to get involved. And so even though he's a child, he knows that the internet is, because it's anonymous, no one knows you're a dog, and you can build your own persona. And so him and Val launch their plot to start writing as Locke and Demosthenes on the internet.
Right.
We check back in with Ender, and some time has passed since his first battle with Rat Army, and now he's the best. We're told he's like the best soldier by far, and that he has his own platoon, and that objectively things are going great for him, but he's really, really depressed. He's kind of stagnated in terms of his innovation and his brilliance. And a lot of that's reflected in his, where he is in the fantasy game. He's stuck at the end of the world. He's kind of in this strange place in the fantasy game where it's not dangerous anymore, that he just kind of wanders around and the world is just kind of this weird place. But it's not the only place that it's dangerous is at the end of the world, where he has to confront Peter's face. And every time he goes there, he dies every time. And so Graf meets with Val back on Earth and convinces her to write a letter to Ender to get him kind of back in the game, to get his head right.
What he says, I wanted Al Pacino, you know, to play Graf, to just deliver this line instead of Harrison Ford, right? Like, because it reminded me of, there are more lawyers, there are more students in law school today than there are lawyers in the end. We are coming out, right? It costs more money for me to fly back to Earth than your father will make in his entire life. We are coming out, guns blazing.
Exactly. The Graf is always, Graf gets, I think, the best dialogue in throughout the book.
Sure.
So Val writes the letter to Ender and tells him that he's nothing like Peter, and she inserts all these kind of tells into the letter, all these inside jokes to prove that's really from her. But of course, Ender kind of sees right through this and sees that this is just more manipulation by Graf. Because obviously the letters before that never got through, and now this one's getting through. So this is just more manipulation. But it kind of works anyway, because he does break through to the next level at the end of the world. He kisses the snake that had previously killed him in the fantasy tower. And it turns into Val, and he walks away. And the chapter ends with Val getting an award that she can't tell anybody about. And then we go back to the battle school with the opening of the chapter Dragon, which is where Ender gets Dragon Army for the first time. And so Ender starts his training sessions, which are very, very different from any other commander for a variety of reasons. And we also meet Bean for the first time. Bean is portrayed as really, really small and kind of a insubordinate kid, but he's clearly really, really brilliant. And Ender kind of does to Bean the same thing that Graf did to him by setting Bean apart from all the other soldiers and making him be the best. And then we get one last moment with Alai, where they kind of reflect on their friendship and realize that now that Ender's a commander, they can't really be friends in the same way that they were.
Right.
And that's where we leave the chapter.
Well, that's an interesting thing. We could jump in there. There's so many places, I think, where we could, jump in. It's an interesting set. It's an interesting set of chapters. I don't know. I think Peter and Val are sort of interesting, because I think that they're the idea that, you know, Peter is just a sort of a sociopath, you know, high functioning sociopath, and Val is like a font of empathy, I think is not true, right? I think is a little problematic and bears some, would bear some unpacking. Val talks about, we went in the Val sections, we sort of stay close to Val and stay close to sort of Val's consciousness and thoughts, in her, you know, in her sections. Actually, even later. Well, no, never mind. No spoilers. So Val is very anxious about the capacity that her empathy gives her to control people, not through finding what they're afraid of or through kind of needling them or exploiting their weaknesses, as Peter does, but rather through, Val is more kind of Madison Avenue. She makes you want things that she wants you to want, and think that you were wanting them, yourself all along, you know? So, I'm very curious about this, and that there's sort of a dark side even to this empathy, right? It's not just sort of boundless love. It's not just sort of boundless love for all mankind. It's a sort of tool. It's a tool that can be deployed, right?
Right, and I think she kind of feels the same way about her ability here as Ender does for his capacity of violence, that sure. She recognizes she has it, but she's kind of scared about the moral implications of using this ability. And it, obviously it's very different from violence, but it's still this, she's scared about the idea that she can manipulate her father, for instance, that, and she's worried, basically the same worry that Ender has, that she's no better than Peter, that is it really that different to make someone want something than it is to make them fear something? Because what is a want but a fear of not having something that you desire?
Sure.
And so I think she's worried that she's going to be like Peter. She's sharing the same worry as Ender has.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of... yeah, it's interesting, right? This is a sort of... They are kind of like a Mary Sue for Redditors.
Right. I mean, we might as well talk about that. There's some great... We talked a little earlier about how the desks they use are like iPads, and of course their foray onto the nets, as they're called.
Sure.
There's some pretty interesting stuff that Orson Scott Card kind of foresees here, that like when you have anonymous internet commenting, here's what you're going to get. And I have a little running list here that like they talk about sock puppeting, how they kind of insert fake debates into their things to make it go right. They talk about trolling, how they sometimes deliberately have voices just to get people pissed off.
Right.
And just a lot of this stuff that I think is just reflective of just psychology. You didn't need to actually have the internet to know that this stuff was going to happen.
Well, it's also like, I don't know, Usenet was established in 1980, for example.
True.
And Ender's Game came on in 1985. So if you were at a university, say, or in a computer science department at a university, maybe, you at least had some kind of like discussion board sort of thing, though the web, right, was years and years off.
Right. That's true. So, I mean, I don't know to what extent he had experience with that, but it's just interesting that was all anticipated on here. Obviously, we're not yet at the point where internet forums are the center of political discourse, but it's not hard to imagine that it might be headed, you know, it might head that way down the road.
Right. Yeah. Congress.
Right. Well, and certainly there are opinion-making blogs. You know, there are a handful of blogs that certain news articles that certainly don't, if they don't define the debate, then they certainly can shift it around.
Yeah, and also there is a discourse around pseudonymy or anonymity on the internet, and like Facebook, you know, famously requiring real names and. Anonymous commenters being sort of less, more the rabble, right? Like less controlled and less reputable. So, okay. So they go on to these things, and Peter does kind of a 180, right? In that now he wants world peace, or at least he wants to ensure the survival of the species, which seems like kind of a selfless aim for someone who's been presented as being sociopathic, right? Like, and
right.
sort of like violence for him. Not only, I mean, here's a little passage from the book. Val reflects that Peter has always been a husbandman of pain, planting it, nurturing devouring it, greedily when it was ripe. Better he should take it in these small, sharp doses than with dull cruelty to children in the school. And she's talking about he's, like, going into the woods and torturing animals and stuff like that. And yet, right, so a few pages later, he always, that is, Peter always, always acted out of intelligent self-interest. And so to keep herself safe, all she had to do was make sure it was more in Peter's interest to keep her alive than to have her dead, right? The idea of someone who's kind of enthralled to sociopathic compulsion is at odds with the idea of someone who is, you know, who is rational and calculating. And I think for schematic reasons of theme, the idea that Peter is, that Peter represents, you know, just, licentious violence, right? And no control and no empathy at all. I mean, I think that that's maybe pushing it a little too far pushing it too far to say that, like, Val is a universal mother to love all creatures. Right. And what exactly is going on with Peter, other than he behaves, really mean. He's a big meanie, as I think I texted you earlier this week.
Right.
Peter is big meanie a lot of the time.
I think you're right on when you point out the rational self-interest, because Peter is, and certainly I think he matures in these few years, and I think later it's assumed that he matures more, is that he has a slightly more sophisticated understanding of,
well, sure,
the world.
I mean,
and
I just want to point out that, like, sociopaths don't mature out of sociopathy. They just, you know, go
get better at hiding it.
Yeah, exactly. They just become Dexter, right?
Right. And I don't think that we're meant to, while he has some sociopathic tendencies, I don't think we're supposed to think that Peter is a sociopath, and certainly in the sense that he's, like, violent and unpredictable. He's willing to use violence. He's willing to do immoral things. He's not limited necessarily by the same moral code that we would hope people are, but he does have goals. I mean, his goal is to take over the world, but not really in a sense of he wants to, you know, rule over a pile of skulls. He wants to rule over a, as he said, a Pax Americana. You know, he wants to rule over a world that's actually knit together into one cohesive whole. And that, to the extent that this goal is maybe just selling Val on the idea, it's a little unclear how much of this he buys.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point with all these personae and all these people, you know, deceiving other people, it's turtles all the way down at a certain point, right?
Right. Like, and we've talked about fake it till you make it before. This is something that, without spoiling the sequels, but some of the sequels deal with Peter as an adult and how he continues his rise to power. And they definitely get into the idea that if you fake being a benevolent and good leader for long enough, it's pretty much indistinguishable from being actually a good leader.
Right. Yeah. That there's a kind of, like, I'm not up on my ethical philosophy, but there's a kind of act ethics, right? Like, the good deed is what matters more than I suppose the good intent, right?
Right. Right. Or just that enough, a habit of good deeds, even if originally in service of, you know, selfish ends, will have an effect on you and make it much more likely that you'll become an actually, even internally, good person, just because that's where you get by acting. You know, the character is nothing but what we do continually. And so one thing I want to touch on, though, is kind of Peter's great version of the great man theory, because
yeah,
he definitely
subscribes to
the great man. Should I talk about
a kind of modified right, great man theory, which is really interesting.
But there's a quote in here: there are times where the world is in flux and the right voice at the right time can make a difference. And this is interesting that he has this theory that not only is it that there are times where it's not necessarily the military strongman or even to some extent the political demagogue, but the kind of the philosopher king can can make a huge difference. I think he cites like Benjamin Franklin as one, and I can't remember the other example he
Lenin
gives.
Was another
Lenin,
one.
Yeah,
and of course actually Bismarck was the
third. Well, and a little later on, not exactly in the same context, but he talks about Hitler a little later, and how Hitler rose to power on words, on, you know, clearly awful words, but Hitler had the message that enabled him to gain power in Germany. He didn't take power because he was the biggest, strongest guy around. He took power in Germany because he had something to sell that Germany was willing to buy at the time.
Well, and that's, I mean, it's really interesting. If you look back historically, I mean, if you're interested in the history, like, and you look back at some of those early, like, I don't even know what to call them, rallies or orations where Hitler is addressing large groups of people. It's not only the language, it's not only the rhetoric, but it's delivered with such ferocious energy, you know, with such charisma, frankly, that, you know, that's part of it. And I wonder, I wonder on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. No one also knows you have ferocious charisma, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, you have to be truly genius if just you're writing alone and not kind of the theatrics of politics.
Well, they're
going to get your message across.
You know, part of the, like, the smartest 1,000 people in the world or something like that. They say right. That, I think.
Right. And I can't remember if it's this book or one of the other Ender's Game books, but this doesn't spoil anything, but it might even be later in the book, but there's a great line where Peter comments that most of the people that are as smart as Peter and Val, like, waste their lives in research or something like that. Like, he implies that, like, if you're a genius and you spend your time, like, you know, making breakthroughs in science, like, that's a waste of your time because you're not doing politics instead. Which I think most people would say is probably the opposite of the case, but, you know, that's neither here nor there.
So the modified great man theory is that, like, a great man is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for large scale social change. There, it also has to coincide with a state of flux in the. A state of flux in the world. It actually reminds me of some stuff that, you know, some stuff that I've read about Shakespeare, right? You know, widely considered the most influential writer in English because of his kind of decisive, you know, his decisive influence on the course of literature after him. But a lot of it had to do with his kind of manifest powers as a poet and dramatist, but also it was at a time, linguistically and politically, where a lot of stuff was still in flux and was kind of forming, right? Like, not too long before, right? They were still speaking Middle English, which was this weird amalgam of Anglo-Saxon and French. And, you know, so modern English, as we understand it, was only just kind of formulating. And it was, you know, it was the right guy at the right time, or in the case of Peter and Valentine, the right boy and girl
family,
right? Yeah. The right family at the right time.
Right. And this is, it reminds me of, if you've read the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, he talks a lot about this, that it's most famous. The book, I think, has got most of the attention for the whole 10,000 hours theory, that if sure. you want to be an expert at something. But he also talks about, and which I think most people miss in the book, is that there's also this idea that you have to kind of, if you want to truly be a titan in certain fields, you have to come at the right, I think it might not be Outliers, it might be one of his other books, but I think it's Outliers. He uses the example of, like, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and, like, nobody's saying that they're not brilliant computer scientists.
Sure.
But he makes the point that they'd been born
20 years before,
right,
and the technology was not up to the vision, and mm-hmm. what do you have?
Right. When he makes the point, even, like, 10 years before, and they probably would have gone to work for IBM, because at the time, there was a certain time where that's where everybody that was in this field went to go do, is you went and got a more traditional white collar job at one of the big tech firms.
If only we had started overthinking it in 2004, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, 10 years after Bill Gates and Steve Jobs are on the scene, well, Apple and Microsoft already exist, so you can't start those again.
Sure.
He gives a number of other examples where it's, you have to do the 10,000 hours, but that's not necessarily enough. You have to also be there kind of at a lucky time.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to be suited to the time. So let's jump back into space and talk about yes. Ender in Battle School and, what he's gonna, what is your read on Kissing the Snake? It just seems bizarre to me.
I've read this book a million times and the whole fantasy game always kind of loses me to some extent. So I'm not exactly sure what's going on there. I mean, I think that the imagery of walking off into the after the end of the world here with Val, I think makes more sense that's kind of what his goal is. But at most, I think it's possibly that he recognizes that he needs to, the only way out of his obsession with Peter is through. That he needs to kind of embrace both sides of himself in order to succeed. That he needs to recognize that he can't just fight the Peter kind of power-seeking side of himself. Because I think that's where he's having this difficulty, is he's reached this kind of, except for being a commander, he's kind of top of the pile. He's the best soldier that's ever been, and he has nothing but respect from everybody. But he's not happy with it because he doesn't really know what he wants or what he is, because he's not ready to embrace kind of his purpose.
That is, I think, like a very sophisticated sort of psychological insight in the book, where he talks about, I'm jumping way ahead, but in Dragon, when he talks about we hear about his last sort of friendly exchange with Eli before he... I actually wonder if the name Eli is chosen because, like, ally, right? Because it sort of sounds like, an ally. That just occurs to me now as I say it out loud. I mean, I read it silently, so hearing it out loud kind of cements that connection for me. But that, like, the wall that sort of goes up once he has his own army, once he's the commander of his own army, and they're now at odds. One of the things that he says is, like, one of the fears that he has is that in fact he's scared that in fact Eli is relieved that the sort of wall, the kind of loneliness of command wall, the isolation has gone up, and that he doesn't have to be friends with Ender anymore, because that's clearly such a terrible thing, mm-hmm. that there is an element in his psychology, and I think it's well observed, because I think it's something that can happen to people. In that people can have kind of second order reactions to their own feelings, or to their own capacity for certain kinds of feelings, like unpleasant feelings like sadness or grief or scary feelings like anger or things like this, right? Like and Ender has this like conflicted relationship with his own capacity, with his own capacities and with his own sort of personality, and so I wonder if so I think what you say about him accepting himself is on the money, and I also wonder if the snake turns out to be Val, and the idea that like the thing that you thought was a threat is not actually a threat. The actual threat is something else. You know what I mean? The actual threat is in the mirror. The actual threat is your idea of yourself. It's not the snake, which is a model of what, like an external, which is a trope of like external danger. That's not where the real danger is. I don't know that you really need to give it a smooch in order to make that point, but
yeah. And of course, part of this is foreshadowing for later in the book, but we'll leave that for a later discussion. One moment in this part with Eli, while we're on the subject, that I think is particularly well observed in this book, is where Ender is at the kind of side practice with all of his other soldiers, and they're joking about going Nova. Is that in this chapter?
Yeah.
That they're joking about the time that they got attacked in the battle room by the bigger kids, and that they fought back and had in retrospect, they're kind of laughing about it. And the other kids are all laughing about it, and then they see Ender and they get quiet and like basically, okay, I'm sorry, I'll get back to work.
Yeah.
Because they don't see Ender as being involved in it at the same level as they were. They don't see Ender as someone that could laugh at a joke. You know, they see him only as their commander and teacher, which I think is, and Ender has this kind of conflicted reaction you're talking about, where he, on one hand, he's sad that he can't take a part of their game, of their joke. But he also doesn't really do anything to become a part of it because he's trying to cultivate this image of himself as a commander. So I think that's right on the second order psychological reactions that Ender has, kind of bouncing back and forth between different extremes.
Well, so let's talk about Ender as a commander, really. I mean, it's of a piece with the kind of, like, you know, Ender is the one that the constraints that he gets an extraordinary set of constraints for his army, though we sort of learned that there's a point to these later on, but it's not like he sort of gets people into the battle room, has them screw up. He does single out Bean for being good, which is not, which is, I suppose, not the kindest thing in the world, and maybe not the best tactic either. And like, he reflects, you know, I don't know, especially on your first day, like even your mistakes have to look like you meant them. You meant them all along. I don't know. I have not, commanded a military unit, but I have been, let's say, a teacher or a director in the theater, right? Like, and I in professional theater, and I definitely know that feeling, right? Like, within the first 30 seconds, you have to establish that you have your hands on the reins, right? Because like, they read you, as another Malcolm Gladwell book tells us, blink, right? Like, they read you in less than 30 seconds, and they know what kind of semester it's going to be, or what kind of production it's going to be, or what kind of team or group this is going to be. And so he gets them in. He doesn't like give them a lecture on, you know, how he wants to like reorient their sensibilities. He gets them into the battle room, and then then gives them tough stuff to do.
Right. And so I made a little list here of even all the things that Ender does differently, and it, you know, we've talked about how this is it's on the military reading list, and that this is kind of the first place where we see like this is some legitimately good. But like, he talks about how what he does differently from the other commanders is that he puts the veterans in the back of the room and the new people at the front, because he wants to make sure that they have visibility. You know, he does the practice before breakfast. He makes his soldiers run naked down the hallways so that in the future they'll be ready to go.
I mean, that's interesting because that's about consistency, right? That's like,
right.
If I had a dollar for every time I had walked on the street past a parent saying, okay, I'm going to count to three, one, two, two and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I really mean it. I really mean it. You know, right? Like, the virtue is consistency, though again, there is this weird kids running around school naked thing.
Right.
Though not weird in Europe, I'm given to understand from some forum comments that we got. Maybe that's just my American preoccupation. Okay, so what else does he do differently?
He does his idea of orientation, that the enemy's gate is down. And this is in interviews with Orson Scott Card, like this is this whole orientation of up, the whole idea of up down orientation, how it kind of loses meaning in space, is really the kind of the genesis of the book, of the whole series.
Sure. From the short story or the novella.
Right. And even the novella was apparently based on Orson Scott Card had read a book about World War I pilots, were always getting shot from either above or below because they were in such a two-dimensional mindset that they would look left, they would look right, they would look behind them, but they would have trouble remembering you have to scan up and down as well in a three-dimensional environment. And he is kind of projecting out that space would be even worse because not only do you not have, not only is it three dimensions, but you don't even have an up and a down as a constant reference point. And the idea was that the battle room would be the way that we would train people to think in this three-dimensional environment. Huh. And then, of course, Ender is the kind of master of reorienting himself and using that as an advantage. And it's interesting that he doesn't get his soldiers to think in terms of no orientation. He doesn't tell them there is no up and down, because I don't think that... I think it's a smart play, because that wouldn't be very helpful, and it wouldn't help. People are going to make an up or down somehow. So he intelligently just realizes that if it's going to be arbitrary, you might as well pick the one that gives you an advantage over the enemy by making it a psychological advantage, by picking a direction of down that helps you out. And then, of course, he doesn't use the formations, he doesn't use lanes, he has this kind of crazy attack position for them to be in. All of which is kind of aimed at this flexible army that he wants to build.
Sure. Agile, he introduces agile processes.
Exactly.
I think the interesting thing is like the subsidiarity is the point of subsidiarity, right? Like he can get involved in at the level of minute tactics, but like his goal as a commander is to set objectives and then to devolve responsibility onto the toon leaders who can actually read the situation on the ground or not on the ground, floating in the vacuum of space, and that this is an interesting management style. It's the same kind of pragmatism, right? That has like, we're not going to go with no orientation, because that would require that everybody be super geniuses and kind of not, and actually like we'd get into like discussions about like inertial reference frames and things like this that are not useful to actually beating the enemy. But what we can do is find a more useful orientation than the dominant one. Until I guess we abandon it and some of the stuff that Bean does later in the book, I think, and no spoilers, but I think that you know, it's clear that Bean is gifted at this, and he'll develop a mentality that is, you know, very advanced sort of later on.
I'll just say something on that. The style of command is actually essentially been adopted by the U.S. military and a number of other NATO armies. It's called mission command. And it's exactly this idea that you as a commander only give the level of order that's needed for your subordinate to know what their mission is. And then they divvy up their mission into their subordinates and all the way down the list. But you avoid micromanaging. You avoid reaching down to the tiniest little level. You don't tell the grunt how to take the hill. You tell the grunt to take the hill, and you know, and then the general tells the colonel which hills to take, and all the way up until ideally, you have the president worrying about grand strategy all the way down to the, it doesn't always work, but that's the theory at least.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, wasn't that I don't know. What's the intellectual history about that? If you can unfold that a little bit, does that have to do with like, Iraq, counterinsurgency fighting, or is it a longer developing phenomenon?
It's longer than that. I'm fairly certain, like everything else, it has its roots in like Prussian military history. I don't know. I'm looking up Wikipedia now. we adopted a lot from like the whole staff command ideas and other things, that it's part of the way that the Prussians ran their military, and it's kind of gone in and out of vogue throughout the years, and it's definitely something that most people in the U.S. military will say they do mission command,
but it's very temperamental. Some people just aren't very good at giving up that level of control.
Sure.
And I think one of the things we're supposed to recognize as Ender's brilliance is he has an intuitive understanding of what level of control is appropriate for a given situation.
Sure.
And instilling in his subordinates a sense of that mission and a sense of when they need to be going up the chain of command for information or when they need to be communicating with each other and things like that. And he kind of starts that right away.
He said, yeah, it reminds me of something that a very great professor, the late John Hollander, said to us once, which is that you can sort of judge your mastery of a craft by whether you can set your own exercises. That is to say, you can evaluate your proficiency and design activities for yourself to increase your proficiency. So like the system is to have no system, or rather not to have no system, but to have whatever system is most effective ad hoc to a particular set of needs. And that is a sort of useful thing. And I think most of us are lucky if we can get it in one field, get that, you know, that level of mastery in one field in military strategy like Ender, or in blogging like Peter and Val.
Or overthinking it.
There was one more thing that I thought was interesting that I wanted to bring up. When Ender is kind of hitting himself in the head over some of the mistakes that he made in his first practice, one of the things he says is, "Do I have to just reproduce the conditions of my? Doesn't everybody just reproduce the conditions of their first commander? You know the part I'm talking about.
Yes.
And for him, that's Bonzo, and so he really doesn't want to do that. But he recognizes that he got a little too authoritarian, or a little too, sort of used too much humiliation with Bean or something like that. And, you know, and I thought a lot about that. And I thought, it reminded me of something that I read once in Kitchen Confidential, the best-selling Anthony Bourdain book, where he talks about very frankly about his limitations as a chef, right? As a craftsman or artisan, as a cook. And he says that he has always been trying to reproduce the early kitchens that he worked in, which were kind of like a pirate ship. So he was like he was in like rat army. He was in like the culinary rat army,
right?
You know, and sort of, so he goes to like, goes behind the scenes at like Thomas Keller's restaurants, or, you know, Le Bernardin or something like that. And sees this like clockwork precision and realizes that he was kind of, he was sort of recapitulating his early experience. And I mean, I don't know, he's only nine. I feel like he's having early, or eight or nine, he's having his early experience. But the idea that like you will become, the idea is that we're not just blank slates, right? Like we come at everything with a set of baggage and a set of like concerns and goals, and also a set of anxieties about who we are, who we want to be, what we want to do, who we don't want to be under any circumstances, you know, and that this sorts of stuff affects our behavior as much as, you know, as much as strategizing does, that there is a kind of unconscious, or that there is a, shall I say, there is a kind of non-self-determined, right, component to our behavior, even when we wish we were sort of making all, we were totally in the driver's seat with ourselves.
I think that's right on. And I think what we see with both Salamander and Rat, and I don't think you necessarily become whoever your first commander is, but you probably either use that as a model of what you want to emulate, or a model to avoid at all costs. You know, it's either it was a positive experience and that's your kind of model to judge everything else off of, or it was such a negative experience that from the future you want to avoid being that leader, whoever it was.
Yeah.
And so, but for Ender, he kind of has this conflicted relationship, because I think he recognizes that what Graf did to him was mean. It was not a nice thing to do to a six-year-old boy, but he recognizes that to some extent it worked.
Yeah.
That, like, it did, in fact, form him into an effective soldier and effective commander.
Well, yeah, I mean, later on when Bean gets his... When Bean is promised... Bean is promised, like, I'll make you a Toon Leader, you know, after the first... after the first practice, Ender actually reflects, and it's clear that he's acting in a way that's a little more intentional there, right. With, like, you know, giving Bean not what he wants, but what he needs in order to, you know, I don't know, in order to kind of develop his to develop his capacities.
Yes, yeah, he's definitely once he realizes he's made this mistake or misstep, he begins to become more intentional about it, and he makes that decision that he's got to kind of keep on the path, but he also makes the kind of subjective internal decision that he's still going to be Bean's friend, that he's going to be kind of looking from behind the scenes and wait for this opportunity to become a friend to Bean.
Yeah, another good leadership, quality, right, is the ability to correct course.
Right.
You know, and not just kind of blunder on once you realize that your strategy hasn't worked, but the ability to improve. And there's quite an art, there's quite a, like, a finesse to it, to do it without seeming either indecisive or weak. I mean, I don't know. I hesitate to say weak because that implies a normative discourse of strength that I think is not entirely the point, but untrustworthy, right?
Right. I think weak is the appropriate word to describe the fear,
yeah,
that people have when they hesitate to change course. Though that's certainly Bonzo's fatal flaw.
Yeah.
Is that he is unwilling to look weak in any capacity whatsoever.
Right.
You know, which even extends to the point of when Ender saves him from losing a battle because it was in violation of his orders, that makes him look weak. So he's not even happy about winning the battle.
He'd rather have lost with control than win by losing control.
Right. And even when he recognizes that changing his course, because there's the previous battle where Ender doesn't fire and Bonzo realizes what could have been if he gave Ender permission to fire and doesn't change course, because clearly any changing of course whatsoever is weakness. And so that is a positive of Ender, is that he's willing to, he recognizes these mistakes that he makes and changes course appropriately.
And one last observation, Ender's Game does kind of get at the dichotomy between sort of institutional authority and something that we might call, like, earned authority. I don't know if there's a better term for it, but being kind of endowed with authority out of a sense of worthiness by the people you're in charge of, right? You know, being trustworthy, being looked up to, right? And it's clear that Ender has that already through his, like, extra practice sessions and through the fact that everyone treats him like a teacher, even though he's a peer institutionally. You know, and that there's an interesting kind of interplay between, like, institutional authority and... institutional authority and, like, actual, oh, you know what we should call it, loyalty, right? The interplay between authority and loyalty is an interesting dynamic to track throughout the book.
Right, and it gets into the off-sided difference between leadership and management. And Ender is good at both,
mm-hmm.
whereas some people are only good at one.
Right.
And leadership is the idea of actually getting people to want to follow you and want to accomplish the goals of the organization, whereas management is the more humdrum aspect of actually getting people from point A to point B so that the goal can be accomplished. And both are important, and Ender is good at both. One more observation I want to make that ends this chapter 10, and I think is an interesting place to end the discussion, maybe kick it to the forums, but Ender is reflecting on both the loss of Alai as a friend and essentially the loss of Val. He sees the fact that they used Val as a weapon against him, as a loss of her, as the same pure relationship they had. And he reflects on all of this as the fault of the teachers. And we, again, we have this comparison of teachers, that the teacher is the enemy and the enemy is the teacher. And that's something we're going to see again and again and again, this idea that there's an interplay between those two things.
That's, yeah, that's very, very interesting. But no spoilers. Let's talk about right. that. Let's talk about that when we get to it. Okay, so you want to join the discussion? Well, the best way to do it is to go into the Overthinking It forums, find the particular week that we're talking about if you're concerned about spoilers for fewer chapters, or for future chapters, rather, or go into the All Book discussion. Ben will post study questions for each week. We'd like to read study questions. We'd like to read responses and forum posts for the relevant week as we record. So hurry on over to the forums and leave comments for chapters 11 and 12 before we over the weekend before we record the next segment. Ben, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
It's been great.
And visit us on the web for more Ender's Game and for more of everything pop culture and Overthinking It, which is where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve.